Welcome to the Johnny Fallon Podcast, the referendum series, where we are taking a look at the referendums that have helped to shape and make modern Ireland and some of the big social and economic issues that have surrounded them, informed them, and how Irish society has been changed as a result of them. This week, we are going back to 1995 and the divorce referendum, which was, of course, the second divorce referendum in Ireland, but was about to meet a very changed country. So settle back, grab a cup of tea or whatever suits you, and let's have a journey back in time to see exactly what Ireland felt about one of the biggest social issues of the time. Well, you are very welcome back to another episode as we continue our journey through the referendums in Ireland and in the modern Irish state. And first of all, a couple of things to clear up for those of you that have been waiting on this episode. I know we've taken a little bit of time in pulling some parts of it together, and we've been distracted by various other things that have been happening. Of course, we've recently had the US elections, and we were putting together an episode around that as well. So lots to be doing, but we are, of course, continuing with our look right through Ireland's referendums. So don't be too upset with us. We will get back on track and we will have more of the referendums to come. Now, first things first on this, in preparing for this and looking at the details and part of the referendum series, one of the things that occurred to me was that, of course, there were lots of legal challenges to referendums in Ireland. And we mentioned some of them, like the Crotty decision before, the McKenna judgment. All of these affect all referendums and how all referendums were made. And one of the difficulties was to talk about these judgments, which actually do happen a lot during the time between the last referendum we've discussed, which was the abortion referendum in 1992. There's a lot of further challenges in the courts to referendum law. However, to discuss them purely in the context of this referendum, the 1995 divorce referendum, puts people into camps and makes it sound like, you know, maybe they were for this or against this. And that's not true, because the judgments were about other things going on, about how referendums were run and funded and all of that kind of thing. So what we've decided is, with those legal questions, if you like, that affect all referendums, putting that into a separate episode, which will be coming to you, to look at exactly how we've dealt with those, the impacts of those, and their impacts behind the scenes in referendums. And when we stick to the referendum itself, as in this episode, we're going to stick to purely the political stuff that matters around the referendum. And then we'll get into that overall piece of referendums and legals and law changes and all that kind of stuff, in the company of some people who are more expert at it than myself. So that's what we're going to do with that. So don't be surprised if we're not covering any of those legal changes that have happened in the meantime. Suffice to know that from the perspective of actually running this referendum, things had changed, and there was a different approach to how information could be used by government and so on. But we are this week talking about 1995 divorce referendum and all that went with it. Now, this was a particularly interesting one because Ireland was changing at pace over the years. And I think I'd like to take a little just quick look back at that, because those of you who followed the podcasts, the election podcasts, and indeed the earlier referendum podcasts, you'll notice this recurring theme. This is the story of how society's changing all the time, how it's developing, how it's improving, how, you know, for some people it's disimproving, and some of the old ways are moved aside and some new fresh thinking coming all the time in society. It's an evolution of a society that you're seeing. But to go back just to what has been happening and put all of this in context, because I think this is important, because for me, this referendum is actually a really important one, 95 and divorce. It's a real turning point in the story. And let me put that in context. You'll know from previous podcasts, 77 election comes with this huge pouring of hope, of ambition. There's a young electorate in 77, an election that's aimed particularly at those young people. And you see a big swathe and change in how political parties campaign and how they run their elections and in who they're appealing to. But with that almost revolutionary sense of change that has developed, you get into the early 80s, and it's all about economic stagnation and the dreams that aren't realised by any of that. And of course, that's problematic for people. It's problematic for the political leaders. It's problematic for society. But that change begins to work through. And throughout the 80s, there's a very... It's painfully slow to watch the development of things like equality and women's rights and social issues. They really do struggle at a very slow pace. But nonetheless, it is happening. And throughout the 80s, that becomes, as Ireland becomes a little bit more aware of its position on these issues, debate becomes to rage. It's in a very negative sense a lot of the time, and you get a view that a lot of these are negative. But it was enough that we had things like Gar Fitzgerald's constitutional crusade. We had parties flip-flopping, not sure which way to go on these issues because they were trying to second-guess the people. And it was a time of you know, slow, gradual change. That begins to, I suppose, reach, you know, the late 80s, because by 87, you know, the last time we discussed divorce was an 86 referendum, which, of course, was lost, and lost badly, let's be honest. And many who were for it said, you know, look, it was too soon, it wasn't well thought out, and there were all those excuses for why it was defeated. And of course, it was rowing against a tide at that time. And the pushback against it was huge, and it had failed. So you get divorce put off the agenda after 86. But a couple of things begin to happen after that that are about society too, and they matter. They matter to a referendum like this, because from 87, the economy starts to change. And it's not that it changes drastically and radically and becomes wealthy or anything, but you know what? The parties kind of, there's agreement between the parties as to what the road forward needs to be like. They've tried everything, and to be honest with you, they've made a pig's ear of it for over a decade more. They're now at a place in 87 where, look, out of time, the right things have to be done, and they could get a consensus of what they knew the right things were. And from 87, you get a period of really strong government, really strong, not just government, but political thought right across the spectrum. There were good figures, there were good leaders, and it's often forgotten in this time that there were, right across all the parties, some very strong, good, visionary people. And Ireland does start, first of all, to get its economics sorted out. Now, it's not dramatic, but the numbers are improving, and there's a sense of optimism building that there's a light at the end of the tunnel on all these economic issues. Growth can happen. The country can get out of this morass it's been in for so long. And because of that, you don't have this overwhelming dark cloud of the economy all the time over everything. And that allows people a little bit of space in thinking of some of these social issues that are just there as well, that have to be dealt with. And politicians often don't like, and a lot of politicians don't like dealing with them. Nonetheless, they're going to have to. And from 87 onwards into 89, you get a sense of a country growing. Now, socially, Ireland changes too. Everybody will tell you, look, sporting occasions and all that, they matter. They matter to how people just see themselves, have a sense of themselves. You know, Italia 90, people always tell you, oh, the mood around Italia 90, because Ireland starts to come out and think, you know what, we can do things. And there is that sporting success. They're looking at athletes worldwide and they're beginning to feel, you know what, Ireland is not a bad, dark place. It's a place that's beginning to have a bit of fun with itself and think that there is a better world out there for it. In 1919, Mary Robinson is elected as president. And there's a huge, it becomes a significant moment because Robinson is a combination of somebody who has fought on a lot of these social issues. And now it's a woman being put in as president. Ironically, the man that she defeats and the man who becomes a symbolism for, you know, defeating male dominance in political parties, is probably one of the few really progressive thinkers in the Fianna Fáil ranks at that time, Brian Lenihan Sr., one of the guys. So a bit ironic that he becomes the symbol of all that was wrong when he was probably one of the guys who was more progressive. There was a lot more non-progressive thinkers, let's shall we say that, in the ranks. But anyway, that's just part of this mood that begins to change Ireland and society as it goes forward. You move into the early 90s, this economic growth continues. Ireland begins to grow and see that boom. It begins to see big success stories in business, in politics and everything else. Things just start to move. And that means people begin to think of Ireland as moving in a changing place. You know, Labour Party in 1992 come in on a wave of hope into government because, again, there's a sense these things have to change. You get the 1992 referendum, and I described that in the last podcast as, you know, you get a sense that the church, as well, has been one of these who has, you know, succeeded in 86 on pushing back, and in the previous referendum on abortion, they've managed to be the bulwark for conservatism in Ireland. And what happens in 92, you get that last abortion referendum that we talked about in the podcast. But one of the things about that, as I said, it's one of the last times that the church really shows that it's able to get any kind of influence, because it gets rebuffed. It gets rebuffed by the politicians in a very in-your-face way. Politicians who were seen to be friendly to the church. Politicians like Albert Reynolds, but they weren't afraid to then turn around and go. That signified Ireland was moving on. Politicians were looking across. They were looking across the House. They were looking at people in the Labour Party. They were looking at people like Mary Robinson. They were saying, being opposed by the Catholic Church is no longer something that can end your career. In fact, it's starting a time where it might actually do your career good. And that's important to keep in mind as we come into context to this. Because even among conservative politicians, certain things are changing. Certain views are changing about how they're going to react in referendums and on social issues and on what happens. So you get this gradual change, but it gathers pace now in the 90s. And from 86 through to 95, another new generation of people is coming on stream who think very, very differently, who are progressive. They're not revolutionaries, but they're definitely progressives, and they want this change. They want to be part. They're part of all the political parties now, and they're demanding a more forward-looking approach, and they're no longer curtailed by fears of what the past was and going back, because they don't know that. They just want this bright future, and they say we've got to be in step with other countries and the rest of Europe and the rest of the world. All of that gives us a sense of, you know, this changed state that Ireland finds itself in. And the political leaders at the time begin to see this change. And that all leads up to having this referendum in 95, because for a lot of the political leaders, there was a question mark over, should you bother? Should you bother with having a referendum? You can focus on the economy, and everybody likes that economy. Everybody likes the idea of, you know, get the jobs, be serious, do all that. But maybe, you know, these big social issues, there's not much change to be gained out of them. Now, political parties, on the other hand, have been following this, and we've seen these change, because one of the things that's changed since the last referendum that we've talked about is, of course, the government. And the government is now going to be led by Fine Gael, Democratic Left Labour Rainbow Coalition. They've come into power because of the fall of the Reynolds Coalition in 1994. And that brings to its own dynamic, because one of the interesting things that happens at the outset of that government is there's a new Taoiseach coming in, John Bruton. And John Bruton, when he comes in, lays out some of his aims for, you know, what he wants to achieve and what he wants to do. And he did that when he became leader of Fine Gael too. And John Bruton is seen very much as a conservative figure. He's known to be conservative in his views, that's kind of liked by a large portion of Fine Gael. However, he also says that one of his ambitions is to bring the divorce issue back before the people and to rerun a referendum on this issue in a better way, more organised way, prepared way, and so on. Now, that's important too, because if you've got somebody like John Bruton, who is perceived as being a conservative, and indeed perhaps even a strongly conservative, definitely on issues like abortion, come to it in a minute, but definitely on those kind of issues, a strong conservative, but he comes out and says, you know, this is one of my ambitions, I'm really strong about this, I want to get this back on the agenda. That's an interesting space, because now you get conservatives who begin to feel, well, you know, maybe this is a different issue. And that's fascinating, because while so many politicians and people will draw a line at abortion, divorce, they begin to separate out. Indeed, just before John Bruton, in that Fianna Fáil Labour coalition, divorce and having another referendum on divorce was also part of the Labour Party's agenda. And to be fair to the Labour Party, they have been consistent on this right through. They've wanted these referendums. They've wanted change on this issue. They've been battling this for decades. That's the party that will really lay claim to the massive change in social issues, because they've forced this. They've demanded it time and time again. They've taken the flak when it wasn't popular to do it, when most people were perceived to be against it. They were for it. And their time is coming, and they've had this boost in the 92 election. Now, they've been getting bad poll ratings ever since, but that's part of being in government and part of the hassle that goes with it. But they had their opportunity for change. But in those discussions, one of the things that happens even in Fianna Fáil is Albert Reynolds, who was considered another conservative-minded politician by the vast majority of people following politics at the time, he remarks to Sean Dighton that, OK, we can do something on divorce, but, you know, abortion is... we don't want to go there, you know, in terms of introducing it. That is a sign, again, of just this change that begins to happen in politicians' minds. And remember, when we think about politicians, they're struggling with all these issues too. They're not like the fount of all wisdom that knows every issue and everything they want to think about, everything. They're feeling out these issues as they go. They're beginning to understand that there's more to these issues than maybe the black and white way they were getting presented in the 80s. So look, you get this change and you get this sense of politicians are now moving to a point where, whereas in the 80s, divorce and abortion were hand in hand and we don't want them in society. There's a definite real change to where people and politicians begin to say, well, okay, we're not sure about abortion yet, but you know what? Divorce is one that maybe we do need to do something about. That's important, because that's a sign you're beginning to move conservative-minded people into a new space. And all of that points to something very important for the 1995 referendum. So when John Bruton becomes Taoiseach with the Labour Party and Democratic Left, and Democratic Left too were quite progressive on these issues, they are definite that they're going to have this referendum, and they're going to put it before the people again. And nobody's quite sure what's going to happen when you do that, because look at, you know, there still hasn't been, if you like, a win for these issues. The best you could say was in that our last podcast on the referendum on abortion, you had the right to travel and the right to information were both voted yes, but the substantive issue people voted no on. And that was seen as, if you like, almost a loss. But it was a loss for all sides, because it was opposed equally by everybody in different angles. So that's an issue in itself. However, there was no sense that anybody had been opposed desperately to information and right to travel. They were side issues. Therefore, we've yet to have a really big win for people who want these social progression and want this change in Irish society. And that's a bit of a problem if you're planning a referendum at this point. So a large part of just the mood around the vote is driven by politicians to who are ready for change, who are ready to take on this change, this huge shift in society, and ready to revisit this issue nearly 10 years on from when it had received a pretty conclusive rejection. Now, in their book, Saving the State, Fine Gael, From Collins to Varadkar, by Stephen Collins and Ciara Meehan, they mention this return to this issue, and they say, quote, "With the economy going well, the government decided that it was time to revisit Gareth Fitzgerald's constitutional crusade with a second attempt to remove the constitutional ban on divorce. Pressure for a second referendum had been building steadily since the late 1980s. A critically important development was the tenacious manner in which the Fine Gael TD, Alan Shatter, managed to get a private member's bill expanding and clarifying the grounds for separation accepted by the Dáil in 1989. It was the first time in 35 years that a private member's bill had been passed by the Dáil. The Judicial Separation and Family Law Reform Bill, with its explicit measures on financial settlements for children, set the scene for a rerun of the divorce referendum. A commitment to hold a referendum was part of the Rainbow Coalition's programme for government, and the issue was put to the people in November 1995. Now, end quote, and as I say, that's from Saving the State, Fine Gael, From Collins to Varadkar, by Stephen Collins and Ciara Meehan. And it provides that sense again that you'd politicians like Alan Shatter before. Now, he was one of the guys you'll remember from the 86 referendum podcast that we did. He's challenged Fitzgerald at that time and said, this isn't right. You've got it wrong here at this time. And he continues on. This has been a major crusade of his and a major push because this is his area of law and he's a lawyer and he understands this issue. He gets this through because there's a lot of stuff going on with separations that's difficult in law. And there's been a lot of confusion about this area and a lot of rights being denied. But it shows that people are beginning to understand. His ability to do that and get that through the Dáil at that stage begins to show that people realise there is an issue here, a bigger issue here. You'll also notice that I think it's important in there that Stephen Collins and Ciara Meehan, they mentioned, but with the economy doing well. And again, that's the important thing that shouldn't be forgotten here. Social issues got pushed right back down the agenda, as did equality, as did all those things. That's what happens when you're dealing with crisis and poverty. It's always one of the first victims. We got to sort this other stuff out here because everybody's going to suffer otherwise. So you know what? Just wait. Wait for your equality and wait for all those, you know, well-meaning good issues. Let's sort out jobs and money and hunger and any of these. Not that maybe they didn't do all that and weren't doing that all that well, but that's the excuse. It takes up what is a finite amount of time that politicians and government and those who work in government have, legislators have, to actually deal with issues. There is a finite amount of time. And the more crises you have, be it economic, be it pandemics, be it anything, that's going to ensure that some big social issues get forgotten and pushed back. Because it's like we don't have the bandwidth, as they would say nowadays, to actually take all that in. But with the economy doing okay, it is time to look back at this. And pressure has been building because people are saying, look, we might have got it wrong in 86, but there's still a mood for change. And as we say, there's this continual growth in numbers of people coming to this vote, coming to this election or to this referendum with a new sense of purpose and a new sense of what they want from society. So they agreed to bring this back to the people in November. Not a great time of the year for it to be out and for have people canvassing, let's remember. Also not a great time of year for weather. So all of these things will also have an impact on turnout and voter turnout. So that's another concern. But this is the time they decide to go for it and the time that they think is opportune to have the referendum. The referendum, the bill for the referendum is proposed by the minister, who's a Labour minister, Mervyn Taylor, who's Minister for Equality and Law Reform, supported by Helen Keogh in that. So they bring the bill forward, it's passed by the Dáil, and we're into referendum space. But you're going to have the same kind of thing happening with regard to opposition. Now, turning to an article John Maher in the Irish Independent wrote on this, just looking back at it and the mood around it, and he said, quote, because the government, with Taoiseach John Bruton at the helm, had rode back on the Liberal wording that had lost at the 1986 referendum, there was widespread belief that the yes vote would be carried early in the summer. There have been significant changes in Ireland since the referendum of almost a decade previously. The judicial separation law came into effect in 1989 and helped to alleviate some of the stress that those wishing to leave their marriages had felt. Mary Robinson was elected as the country's first woman president in 1990, and in a move that would speak of greater tolerance for all, homosexuality was finally decriminalised in 1993. End quote. Now, I think John Maher puts there that the mood that you get early in the summer, they've been looking at this and saying, we're having this referendum, bring it forward, going to have it in November. And there's quite a lot of feeling that they can get this through, because they pull back from going very liberal. So it's coming with lots of conditions and all that kind of thing. You're going to have to be, you know, a certain length of time separated before you could even apply for divorce, a couple of years, 4 years. All of that's been thrown out there. So it's a little bit more, it can appeal to a middle ground a little bit more. So they're confident of this and confident of where this can land with the Irish public. It's not always that easy, though, and you can see, you know, that why they feel emboldened at this. As you said, homosexuality, and it seems like a small thing now, but it's only been decriminalised in 93. That's Labour and Fianna Fáil in the Reynolds Spring coalition just before that have decriminalised homosexuality. And what was interesting about it was, again, it was Labour that really were pushing that one. But they had at the helm something that they wanted, something that demanded, something that the Fianna Fáil leader, Albert Reynolds, kind of shrugged about and said, well, I've no issue with it. So, you know, he wasn't someone who was driven by those kind of social issues in that. But yes, this is your bag. You want this. He got it. And it went through without a whimper. And that kind of surprised people, because there would be some expectation that maybe there would have been some, particularly in Fianna Fáil. Reynolds has decided to do that with the usual thing of, it was his style of, I've decided it, I've done it, it's through, get on board or get out. And that style of leadership means that you get these big leaps forward, because it's there, creates some tensions on the ground, but he forces it through. And then people are going, if these kind of issues can be accepted just like that, and then we move on and the sky doesn't fall in, then, you know, why are we always having these big moral arguments about these kind of things? So you can see that all of that's there. It's all built up to a sense of, as I say, politicians not being afraid of church anymore, not being afraid of being on the other side of these debates. There is an opportunity now to bring this to the people, and that's why it's gathered pace over these years. So they start out with quite a sense of confidence in what they're going to do. Now, the same kind of voices, though, are always going to be there, and there's always going to be some of the people that you would expect to have opposition to this. One of those was, of course, the church. And all eyes were on the church and what it would do in this referendum. Now, but things were changing for the church too here, because there had been a huge amount that was going to affect, church thinking on this. Now, to give context to one of the problems Ireland has with divorce is actually because of this very weird relationship that's now happened between church and state. Gareth Fitzgerald talks about this in his writings too. But, I mean, look, I'm just going to summarise it here, because you have this very strange, other countries don't even have this issue, even though some of them are well used to dealing with church and state. But there's a very weird thing in Ireland at around this time where, you know, everybody who's got married in the church knows the kind of process. You go to the church, you get married, you sign a form, whatever. Then the priest registers that with the civil authorities, and civil authorities take that and you get your civil marriage cert to say you're married and all of that kind of thing. Now, weirdly, in for Church of Ireland, or indeed even in the Catholic Church, there is a process called annulment of your marriage. So you can get a marriage annulled. It's a very difficult process. It's not big numbers or anything else that get this, but you can get a marriage annulled for various specific reasons. And that does happen. In other countries, the Catholic Church is quite clear. And if your marriage is annulled by the church, by Rome, you then need to square that with the civil authorities by getting your civil divorce, and then you go on with your lives and you can remarry. In Ireland, we've this weird thing that the church here has fought against the introduction of any kind of divorce and said that this would be wrong, so we don't have divorce. So even if you go to all the trouble and you manage to get your marriage annulled, and the Catholic Church says, okay, we don't recognise that marriage ever happened, it's annulled, therefore you're in the clear to marry again, you can't, because there's no way to get out of the civil marriage. And it's a really weird little thing that's happened. And then when you say, well, okay, so then can't we have civil divorce? No, because that would destroy society. So you get people who are even Catholics who are kind of like, well, you know, if you get annulled, surely you should be able to marry again. Well, you're not going to be able to, not in the eyes of the state. And the Catholic Church are the ones who have steadfastly stopped the state from having the very kind of system. Now, not the same. I mean, we wouldn't put annulment and divorce. They're much more complex, and to throw them in the same thing. But at least the Catholic Church is a system for dealing with a problem, and it won't allow the state one. And that creates these kind of anomalies. These stories creep up time and time again and create that kind of difficult narrative that begins to people realise this isn't as simple an issue as we thought. However, the church has also got this kind of issue at this point that its power is on the wane. One of the reasons it's on the wane is, as we saw in the previous referendum, you could see that erosion beginning to creep in the early 90s, where politicians had a lot less fear of what the church was saying and doing. The other reason is it's been eroded at its core, at its base. The church is now getting consistently embroiled at this point in scandals. Scandals particularly in relation to child abuse, institutional homes. These are going to get worse and worse over the years, but they're growing, and people are now in the first wave, the very first wave, if you like, in the early 90s of the general Catholic population in Ireland beginning to go, hold on, you know, why am I listening to this when these guys have, you know, covered up or seem to be covered? Now, they still weren't aware of the scale of it. They still were willing to go, you know, mass populations. But the first big doubts had started with, and the church is struggling to deal with what is an erosion of its own base, where people are going, I don't have to take lectures anymore from an institution that seems unable to actually lecture itself and deal with wrongdoers within it. And the view of an awful lot of Catholics at this point is they trust their church, they trust their priests, they trust the nuns, they trust the people around them. They say, look, we know many, but many of them still have family members and all in it. They trust the majority, but they are very much aware that there's been a core who need to be rooted out. And what worries them is they're not seeing that happen. And one of the problems of the Catholic Church is, again, this big old institution, been around for thousands of years, it moves painfully slowly, and it's losing ground fast, and it doesn't even know it at this point how fast that ground is shifting underneath it. And its inability to actually shift and move on that ground is going to cost it big time. However, turning to John Maher and his piece in the Irish Independent about this, he says, quote, furthermore, rumblings have begun about the clerical sex abuse that would threaten to tear the Catholic Church apart as the 1990s wore on. But unlike the marriage equality referendum of this year, where the church largely took a back seat, the Catholic hierarchy still felt emboldened enough in 1995 to argue strongly that the introduction of divorce would threaten the sanctity of Irish marriage. The No side liked to see itself as the outsider taking on the establishment and various D4 liberals. It was made up of a loose collection of vested interests, including the Christian Centrist Party, Teachers Against the Amendment. It also had some high-profile figures who became staples on TV as summer gave away to autumn, including law expert William Binchy and ex-High Court Judge Rory O'Hanlon. End quote. Now, you'll remember again from the last podcast, ex-High Court judge Rory O'Hanlon was a guy who kind of had issues with the abortion referendum as well and said, you know, God's on my side kind of thing, you know, you can't do this. And the Taoiseach of the day there, Albert Reynolds, like, kind of kicked him out of his position and said, off you go, you're in the way, you're out. And again, causing those tensions and people saying that was part of the struggles of that government. Now we have a new government coming in, you get this ex-judge coming up again. So you see the same faces arise. And as it says there, the no side in this do see themselves as, you know, they're now fighting the establishment. And that's a change. There was a time, by about 86, they might have believed they were the power, they were the establishment, and they were stopping these new voices emerging, particularly in the media, and eroding Irish society. 10 years on, there's a definite change here. Their view of themselves even now is, we're fighting the establishment, we're fighting the big political parties who are there pushing an agenda, we're fighting a media, a Dublin 4 liberal, trendy type media who just want to push on younger people these ideas with no sense of the damage it will do to society. We're holding back the sea here. We're fighting a wave, and that's what we've got very little resources, very little money, but we're holding it back. We're going to go out there, we're going to fight it hard against all the political establishment, against this all-powerful media that's just purporting to represent, you know, views, but is pushing one line. And you see the same voices arise time and time again in the no campaigns, because it becomes a thing that's how they see themselves. So they've to stop every erosion, every referendum, every issue. It's not an issue by issue thing even. It's what they see as a breakdown of everything of society, everything that's been known, everything that's been understood. And then there are different elements to that, some religious, some social, some political, who all come together to try and argue the case against the referendum. And of course, that is a major threat for the government. It's a major threat for anybody else on the outside, because when you get a group and they're able to say, listen, we're just fighting against the storm here, it can create, and this is around this time you get this really strong sense that there's a silent majority, that yeah, maybe the media are selling all their newspapers in Dublin and the RTE and everybody else are spouting stuff out to, you know, people. But, you know, there's a person down the country somewhere and there's a silent majority of them who don't like to say it, but they're uncomfortable with all this. And they believe that. And that's where we start to get this, which will stick with Ireland over the next 20 years, this continual view that there's in every referendum a silent majority who are about to come out. And sometimes it seems to be there. Sometimes it's something you can't put your finger on that changes with turnout and those kind of things. But it's the continual lines, this idea that and politicians start to get scared of this because they start to think, well, hold on, it seems to be everything's pointing in one direction, but I don't want to be caught offside by the time the next election comes up to find that my own people are actually really against it and they all vote me out. That opportunism of politics creates a problem too, because that's the career politician thinking rather than the politician who's there to actually make the difference. But that's what happens. That's politics. That's the society and system we've got. So all of that leads to a very difficult group arguing against the campaigns. Now, politically, though, it wasn't all plain sailing either for the major political parties and where they were going to go with this referendum. And if we're going to talk about those parties, of course, we've got to remember that you have Fine Gael, who have a Conservative leader in John Bruton who's pushing this. So they're probably helping to shore up a strong Fine Gael support base there. You have the Labour Party, who will bring with them all of the progressive voters of that time, or the people who may be seen as more liberal. They've already got a good base there, and Democratic Left in the urban areas. So you've got a strong coalition there in the government who can pull these voices together, along with other parties, from Progressive Democrats, others who are looking at pulling those up. But the big beast in the room is still there at this point, Fianna Fáil. And Fianna Fáil is over on the opposition benches. And what becomes critical now is what will Fianna Fáil do in this referendum? Because Fianna Fáil still has anywhere up to over 40% at the last election, which was its worst election. It got over 39% of the vote, so nearly 40% of the vote. It's polling well higher than that now. It's looking like, you know, a party that can and does hold over 40% sway. So if Fianna Fáil goes against things, it still has the power here to swing votes and referendums. And Fianna Fáil, very definitely under Charles Haughey in 86, took a very much a move as part of its all-out opposition party that it was going against that referendum, and it really did help to take that referendum out. If Fianna Fáil goes against this, you've got a major problem. It now becomes a political battle. Of course, in Fianna Fáil, leadership has changed as well. Albert Reynolds has been deposed and has been replaced by a young leader in the terms of the times, Bertie Ahern. And Bertie Ahern is seen as a very new face of Fianna Fáil. He's seen as, you know, somebody coming from the finance portfolio. He's well liked. He's urban. He's Dublin. He's got a lot going for him. But Bertie Ahern is also the guy who will always show up on Ash Wednesday with his ashes on his forehead. He's well known to always attend mass. He does the very thing that you expect of a leader of Fianna Fáil at this point. He's pulling all sides of the broad church with him in a brilliant style at the time. He is able to say, I am a strong Catholic, but you know what? I'm well in tune with the urban voters, and where he's appealing to all sides and all people in a very broad way. He's a completely different guy to Albert Reynolds. He doesn't do the, listen, you're on, you're off, in, out, get out, we'll get this through. He doesn't do that. That's not his style of leadership. He's a real, let's reach a compromise. Okay, don't need to feel threatened by me. Let's do a deal here. Let's get it through and let's work together. And he will compromise anything in order to make a little bit of progress. But that means he can stay in power. He can stay in control. He can stay at the... And that's very different. And Fianna Fáil has been tired of this roller coaster of huge successes met by absolute clashing rows that was marked the Reynolds era. Very different now under Bertie Ahern. Of course, the other thing to remember, though, is that while Bertie Ahern does all those things that maybe the Catholic voters might like and rural voters might like, Bertie Ahern is also separated. He is no longer with his wife at the time. He is known to he is known to be in another relationship. Everybody knows it. Everybody talks about it. So everybody looks across and starts to say, you know, well, what's Bertie want? Bertie probably just wants divorce himself. That's why he's here. He's going to get divorced. So will Bertie just vote for the divorce because that would suit him? The same thing was being said about politicians like Rory Quinn. You know, this kind of way of undermining them by saying, you know, well, you know, Rory Quinn wants divorce because he wants to get divorced. That's why he wanted some personal thing rather than it being something they actually cared about in society. And that is a way of undermining what politicians think and what they say and what they do. Noel Whelan touches on this in his book, Fianna Fáil, Biography of the Party, and he says, quote, the Rainbow Coalition proposed another constitutional referendum to revisit the issue. In 1986, when the previous divorce referendum had been held, Fianna Fáil had adopted a policy of official neutrality on the proposal. But in reality, party activists had formed the core of the no vote campaigners in many constituencies. This time around, Ahern and his front bench announced that Fianna Fáil would support the holding of the referendum and would call for, though not campaign for, a yes vote. Obviously, Ahern's personal circumstances as a separated man, publicly in a second relationship, gave an additional dimension to the party's support for the proposal. At a number of media events during the campaign in November 1995, Ahern, Geoghegan Quinn and Mary O'Rourke strongly and unequivocally urged voters to support the proposal. Fianna Fáil's intervention in the campaign probably proved decisive. End quote. there's an important couple of points there in it, because as you see, like, yep, in the previous referendum in 86, it wasn't a Fianna Fáil kind of campaigned us, but as part of this kind of thing, Haughey had always been this all-out opposition. We hate this government, we hate everything they're doing, and he'd engendered that into the support base. So when they come out, he doesn't even have to go, oh, we're voting no to this. He comes out and just kind of equivocates, you know, well, we're neutral, neither forward or against it, because there's enough things to be there, knowing full well that having engendered that culture in the party, Fianna Fáil is really against it in 86, because the core of that, the knowledge base, the expertise on the ground, all that comes back to Fianna Fáil and Fianna Fáil people at the time, who felt it was, you know, free rein to go against this if you wanted. Now this is different in 95. And Ahern does something in coming out. And again, you can see there's a little bit of hesitation there, because Fianna Fáil has to take things slowly in their eyes. He says, we're not going to campaign for it, but we are going to support it. So Fianna Fáil is not going to be out there. You're not going to have them knocking on your door. You're not going to have anything like that. But as a party position, you support it. Now, I remember this campaign, and I remember too in Bertie Ahern being, at the beginning, you know, listen, we're a Republican party, and a Republican ideal would be that you have to have something like divorce. That's what we're here for. That's the idea of Republicanism, which he tried to appeal to that part of the party. And he kind of said, but look, I totally understand if people have a moral problem with this. Over the course of the campaign, he's forced into more and more stronger statements on it, because that's what happens and it gets tougher. But Fianna Fáil, Noel Whelan says it was decisive. Probably was, because in the end, as you'll see, this is a very closely fought referendum. And the reason it becomes closely fought is people begin to have doubts as it goes on, and people begin to have fears about it as it goes on. So yes, if Fianna Fáil, would Fianna Fáil being out against us or that have swung it the other way? Yes, probably that will be a safe assumption to say. So it was decisive from that point of view that he managed in. But Fianna Fáil still has a very divided base on this issue, even in 1995. And it causes all kinds of issues for the party, because there are elements of the party and places in the party, particularly in its younger membership, that are very much for this and would like that strong position. People like Máire Geoghegan-Quinn and Mary O'Rourke are essential to this debate, because they know these issues, they get these issues, and they are pulling this party with them into a kind of a, come on, we have to think a little bit more forward thinking here, and we have to get away from this. And they understand that. They're put out front and centre to try and pull this around from the perspective of Fianna Fáil, who have this real battle. And that conservative heart of Fianna Fáil at this point is an essential battleground within the party and for other parties looking at it, wondering how well can they be brought over to this side. Now, let me give also a personal insight into two things at this time. Obviously, when the 86 referendum was run, there was a sense that, you know, I was a kid at the time, but I remember following it because there was always a follower of politics at this stage, and, you know, in the house discussing it, and that, you know, there was definitely a sense divorce was wrong and this was not right for the country and we didn't want it to come in. We were a Fianna Fáil house, we were in that zone, but we were definitely against it. That's what I knew. Divorce wasn't good to come in, and it would be good if it was defeated. And I was very much aware of that. Now, 10 years on, I was a lot more involved. And, you know, we were talking about my time going to college here and that kind of thing. So I've seen a lot more of the world from my own point of view. And, of course, have been serving and was serving at this point in time in Fianna Fáil and at the Comhairle Dáil Ceantar in Longford, and with various figures, Albert Reynolds being the TD, working with them on various issues and all that kind of thing. So had seen up close on this, what it was. But there's a couple of things I want to say here that maybe give insight into what Ireland was and the differences and how Ireland changes over this time. I certainly would have come to this now as a young person with a lot more open mind of why is divorce this big issue? Now, I was aware in the discussions I would have with my parents about it that they too had moved equally on a little bit from that 86 position, that there was an evolution there. However, a new argument had come into this, which was, can the country afford it? The government haven't done their sums, and there's going to be a huge expense on the state from looking after all of the bills that come out. So until the government actually comes out with a financial plan for how it's handling, you know, broken homes, people left, you know, all of the bills that are going to hit as a result of widespread divorces coming in, we need to see more financials. And that was a strong argument, and one that I admit at the time I had to sit back and think, because I didn't want to be not considering that position. I wanted to consider, well, hold on, is that an issue? And have the government, and the numbers looked a little bit like, well, I'm not sure there is a huge amount of financial planning for what happens after this. And that's what you need sometimes when you're on the no side in this. You need a reasonable argument. And they began to introduce these reasonable arguments. Let's not get into these emotional stories. Let's talk about the economics of it, for instance. And there was a certain group particularly being moved by that, saying, hold on, this, you know, let's go back to the economy's just started to grow. We've just started to sort out the jobs. Everything's getting good. You know, hold on. Let's push the social issue back a bit. You know, is this the time to introduce divorce? And we don't know whether we can afford all the bills that might arise out of it for the taxpayer. That's your reasonable argument now that begins to infect a certain amount of voters. And they begin to think, hold on, maybe this is another rush job like 86. Maybe they haven't thought it through. And if you're a Fianna Fáil voter, that's a good one to get, because you're no longer stuck in this moral judgment. You're now back to a firm economic ground of, it's the usual here. They're going to put the economy at risk here with this. And that's not where Fianna Fáil voters traditionally see themselves. So from their point of view, that becomes an issue. One I was struggling with, I think, at the time myself. Now, to give you also a little sense of Ireland at the time and what happens, because I was in Longford, and Longford will be one of the counties that will reject and has a record, quite a conservative voting record in referendums, certainly at this point and into the future for a while. It gets quite conservative. There's a lot of rural population in the county as well, even more so at this point in time, probably lack of diversity within it. But all of that is, it's particularly, you know, it plays into what you know and what you understand. You know, when I met my wife many years later in Dublin, I have to say, you know, she was used to a situation where she lived in Dublin. Many of the people on her street had separated. Some had divorced. She had family members. Some had separated. Some divorced. You know, she had a huge amount of her circle of friends where people had, you know, parents who had separated, divorced, broken up, whatever. I didn't have any of that. And certainly by 1995, at that point, even, it was worse. You know, I came from a very rural part of the country where I didn't see anybody's marriage break up. I didn't know. There was nobody in my class, in my school, that I met and their parents had broken up. It just was something that was utterly never heard of. And even when I went into Longford Town and went to St. Mel's College, I wasn't aware of kids whose parents had broken up. It just didn't happen, really, you know. And then after a while, yes, you would hear something of, oh, some marriage. But you know what? I'm not saying it didn't happen. It was that we never heard of it. It wasn't discussed, and it wasn't something that was out there. And it was an element for people in that situation. Unfortunately, there was an element of shame that came with it. So they didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to talk about difficulties. And I do believe there were a huge amount of marriages that probably should never have been staying together. That should, but you know what? It was almost worn like a badge of honour. And I was raised at the time to always think of the same things. I was always told, you know, one day you'll grow up and you'll meet a girl. And you know what? Marriage is going to be tough. Marriage is hard. It's never easy. You know what? It's not a Disney film. You don't have a kiss and go off and never have a crossword between you for the rest of your time. It's going to be a lot of hardship and a lot of toughness and a lot of sticking together. And that's what it's about. But you know what? You take your time when you meet the person. You figure that they're the right one. You only get married when you know they're the right one. And then you know, you work at it and you put in all that work over the years and you stick to it. And I believed everybody was doing that because everybody around me seemed to be in the same position. Marriages just didn't break up. Of course, you know, when you get older and you look back, you know an awful lot of that was a lie in terms of that there were marriages that, you know, just had broken up effectively. People weren't being given second chances. There was a lot of suffering too by people. And you hear stories much later and you think, oh my God, you know. And there was everybody thinking everything was fine. But the reason I say that is that it's to give you a sense of when you're coming from counties around the country where this isn't an issue and it becomes, or it's perceived not to be an issue. I want to be careful here on how I word these things because it doesn't matter. It's perceived not to be an issue. We don't need this. We're fine. Get on with running the country. We'll get on with our marriages. And that's that. And it becomes very easy at that point to get sucked into that way of thinking and thinking, you know, there isn't a need for it. It's different. When you go and you go when you're in Dublin and you're living there and it's much more widespread simply because of the volume of people, if nothing else, you then realise, yeah, you know what, this is part of life and it does happen. And as society changes and we become more open to it and we lose the elements of shame, people are able to talk about things that are happening to them and understand what was going on. That changes it. But, you know, look, and I'm not saying marriages are tough. They are hard. They are difficult. They are all those things. It wasn't that it was wrong in teaching that, but what was wrong in teaching it was that you stick with it at all costs. And there was that sense. And you just had to do that. And therefore, it was something of an unsympathetic road that had come to dealing with divorce as an issue. Now, as a result of that, I remember going into a meeting in Longford, Corlathall, Cantor at the time where divorce was one of the things and the upcoming referendum was going to be discussed. Now, as I say, I'd now at this stage been quite a few years in and involved and working hard at it, so there was no difficulty for me to be speaking on an issue or talking on it and being respected among the group, which they were a great group for at the time, in welcoming younger people and voices in and allowing them influence on it. But I always remember this as being one of those kind of moments because it taught me a little bit of a lesson. At the outset of the meeting, and I mean, just remember, this is a time before Facebook, Twitter, anything. So you didn't have any place to express your opinions or tell people. If you went to the pub, people usually said, oh, don't start the politics, it'll get into a row. You know, so you didn't have anywhere to say it, except maybe at your party meeting, where it was, yes, we're here to discuss this. Nobody in that room was going to change the divorce referendum. Nobody was actually campaigning there. They were all talking to their own internal party group. But you know what? They were all talking as in, you know, this is our chance to lay out our beliefs and maybe bring other people with it. And I remember at the time, I think it was Eileen McLaughlin, who was part of the Ogra group at that time. And she, you know, touched on this subject that, you know, it we have to consider this. And this is important at the time. And this is important, you know, that we begin to give consideration to these things. And, you know, fairly nice, middle of the road, but, you know, certainly pointing in a direction. And the speeches took on from there. And all I can say to you about it is that there are a number of people, strong figures, some who were very good figures and very good people in many respects, but they took on a voice opposing this referendum with a vitriol that I have rarely seen at meetings. And one speech in particular by one individual on it, the comments made about Bertie Ahern, the comments made about his relationship, the comments made about what he was and wasn't, you know, look, they were nothing short of disgraceful. But it was thrown out there and them feeling because it's a rousy speech and there's a few people agree, they applaud and then everyone applauds. And then some other people get emboldened and they come up and they too are attacking this and it's the very heart of this, that and the other and the party. And it was really, really hugely negative against Fianna Fáil leadership, hugely negative against the position the party was taking and was being, you know, and I remember thinking, if we all leave this room, everybody's going to assume here that we're all agreed that we're opposed to this. And I remember speaking out against it, or against them, saying these kind of things and saying, look, this is a major social issue and there are people, and this is about lives and what people and how they're affected by this. And irrespective if I have made up my mind is irrelevant, irrespective of anybody in the room making up their mind is irrelevant. But what we cannot do is get into this circle of abusive arguments and reducing it to a common. There are issues and those issues must be considered. There are women who have suffered in marriages and have no way out. There are people who have been shamed by this and told that, you know, there's a humanity and a compassion that has to be at the heart of everything this party was about, everything the party represented. Anyway, made the point, definite. It too got applause. But what amazed me about the out of it was that afterwards, several people came and then said, yeah, I didn't like to say, but I, you know, I agree, you know, I don't want to say, but you know yourself, there's a lot of people, you know, disagree with it. And it did remind me forevermore, be it social media, anywhere else, it that old thing of, you know, if you do nothing, you assist it. If we all just keep, it taught me one thing. You keep quiet in a room and you say it's going to be a tough argument and everyone seems to be this. That's what everyone does. And then everyone does leave the room or does go off Twitter thinking everybody's the same opinion because nobody's brave enough to stand up and go, hold on, don't care what it brings on my head. I disagree with you guys. And you have to do that sometimes. And it was an important lesson. But in terms of this referendum, it does show you that within Fianna Fáil, there was a lot of debate and a lot of acrimony going on. And it wasn't easy for some of the people who were coming out and leading this, but they did lead it and they did lead it from the front within the party. And that vote could indeed prove decisive in the referendum. But they weren't the only fears that were going to get played upon within it. There was also this idea that there was going to be huge amounts of women left destitute, that husbands were going to abandon women and children and walk out on divorce, and then they were, who's going to support them? We know now that didn't materialise, but it was a threat that, you know, sure, there's loads of fellas out there be going away. And then on the other side, there was equally the threat. There was a very famous poster that came to define this referendum, and it simply said, hello divorce, bye bye daddy. And that played on this other set of fears that there were women out there who had, they would get the rights to their children, they would take their children, get rid of this fella that's been hanging around, bye bye daddy, we don't need daddy anymore, that's the end of it, daddy's going to be gone in the divorcing. And it played on the fears of a lot of men who were, well, you know, give the women half a chance and they will be up and gone, because maybe they knew that, you know, well, maybe I'm not the biggest catch, but I don't want to be, you know, divorced, don't let her divorce me. Which is a bizarre mindset when you think about it, that, you know, the fear is, well, if you allow divorce, my wife will just walk out on me, you know, poor me. You know, if you get to that position, guys, I think, you know, you want to sit down and have a little bit of look at what you're doing. I think it's more than the law you need to figure out there. However, this did have an effect. It did have an effect over the course of it. As I said, there was the reasonable argument, economics, cost. That's underlying, it's not one of the ones they're pushing out there, but it's getting in at the base. It's getting in at the base who don't want to be moralising about it, but they can be worried about it economically, and it can seem like a very sound argument. There's the women are going to leave men and the poor men. And then there's men are going to leave the women because we know there are some men are just philanderers, and sure, look, we're all going to be left supporting then these deserted families. These kind of things begin to eke away at people and people begin to get this fear. So what starts out in the opinion polls is a really strong election begins, or a really strong referendum position seems to ebb away as we go on through the referendum. Then we come to the bishops and the church, because they're the next big block. If you've got Fianna Fáil having its row over there, it could also be decisive as people see it. If we can get the church on side, and if the church can come out now and say, because that's what people still has influence, maybe it's waning, but you know, let's put it to the test, let's see. So the church comes out and the bishops decide that they're making a statement which is the heart of marriage. I'm going to quote a little bit from what the bishops reckon in this vote, because they come to a position where they decide that, you know, divorce is not something they can recommend and that they don't want to see divorce introduced in Ireland. However, they say it's not a sin if you do vote for it. You know, I'm just going to say cover that off at the beginning, because, again, you've just got to think of the position the church is at here. And some, John Bruton and a few others, will say that they believe the church's intervention actually harms the no side on this. Obviously, there's some support and it does help them in some ways, but there are probably people it does that it might be reasonable to say that about, simply because the church is dealing with all these issues that are only coming to light now, and people are beginning to have doubts about the leadership of the church. And it comes out with saying, well, you know what, we think you should vote against this referendum, but if you vote for it, at least we'll tell you it's not a sin. Lads, seriously? That's your position? You think your big gift here is the fact that it won't be a sin? I mean, yes, that matters for Catholics, but considering what they're seeing in the church at the moment, at this time, emerging, I don't think the sin of how they voted in a referendum is what they're worried about, because they're seeing a hell of a lot of forgiveness, acceptance and understanding for some very big crimes going on within the church as they see it. And again, the church fails to realise that it's building its house on sand here. It's appealing to Catholics' understanding of sin, but it's not applying that same barrier, that same standard. It's not applying that elsewhere. And that annoys some Catholics of, you know, really? You know? And again, I lived in a Catholic household and it did have an impact in that Catholic household from that point of view too. Now, I know it's only my experience, but I remember my parents feeling irked by the, you're going to tell me it's not a sin if I do want to vote this way. I'll vote that way if I want, and you don't get to tell me when I go out and exercise my democratic right that that's a sin. Not given some of the things that are getting told aren't sins or are forgivable sins or anything else. You know, it just irked a lot of Catholics too. So maybe it did. On the other hand, many were swayed by what was said in it. The bishop's statement said, and just not going to read all of it, but to quote some elements of it, they said, quote, divorce would mean that if either partner wishes to repudiate the marriage promise, the courts will treat the promise as not meaning what it said. Divorce would mean that a spouse who earnestly wishes to stand by that promise may hear a judge declare, you are no longer a husband, you are no longer a wife, end quote. Now, just to say on that, here's the first position the church takes is, I want to stop it and mention this because it's an important part of the referendum, which becomes this feeling that, you know what, people will be divorced who didn't want to be divorced. As we say, it's daddy, bye-bye daddy. Daddy didn't want to be gone, but, you know, mammy got rid of him. Or mammy mightn't want to be divorced, but daddy decides he wants to be divorced, so bye-bye. And the judge then decides, yeah, you're no longer married. And that person says, I honestly want to be married to that person. Again, we're getting into the extreme case. How many of those cases are there where somebody really wants to remain married to somebody who says, I have no feelings for you whatsoever and I want to be gone from you? Do really that many people go, well, I'm going to stay with you no matter what? You know, again, it speaks to a view that they have of what's going on in marriages that people in many areas don't see as a reality or an understanding of reality. It's a theoretical view of what might be happening rather than the reality. And that creates a problem in how people are digesting this. However, it does give weight to the idea that this could happen and that therefore some people feel, well, we do want to be careful. Goes on to continue quoting from the bishop's statement. Quote, it is not a question of whether the teaching of the Catholic Church should be enshrined in the Constitution. The fact that a particular provision is in harmony with Catholic teaching is not in itself a reason to retain it, nor it is a reason to remove it. The issue should be decided in light of the social implications of divorce. End quote. here's the next point that gets introduced here. And this is the church saying, look, this isn't about trying to keep Ireland Catholic or having a Catholic in it. Not interested in that. This is, you know, they've seen a certain changing wind here. But they're saying it's the implication this has for society. And this becomes the next big debate. It begins to move people along here. They begin to say, well, yeah, forget about the whole whether I'm a Catholic or not. Is it good for society? And more voices on the no side start coming out. These independent groups talking about what happens society. What happens when the family is no longer the unit that we all work around. And even progressive thinkers like Gareth Fitzgerald are, you know, do mention this time and time again, that the family has a reason in the economic sense. It has a reason as a societal way of organising. So it does have a purpose. Now, if you start putting that in and you're saying, well, let's forget of religious things. Let's talk about societal, socio-economic stuff. Family is kind of a good way to organise, and you might be losing that now. That becomes a threat and a problem. And again, people begin to worry about this. Going back to the bishop's statement, it says, quote, the proposal to introduce remarriage would insert into law the principle that the marriage promise does not mean what it says. Should the referendum be passed, the word marriage will have two different meanings. The church will always see marriage as an unconditional pledge for life. The state will regard it as a promise that can be broken at the request of either party. Marriage in the Catholic Church would differ profoundly from marriage as Irish law would define it. End quote. Now, again, you see the Catholic Church here, and they're making it quite clear here. You're going to have a divergence here. Marriage in the church is very different to what marriage in the state is going to mean. We believe marriage is for life. Now, let's not get into that little technicality I mentioned earlier, that we can annul certain marriages and then you're still stuck into them by the state because we won't allow the state a mechanism, which we do allow in other countries and actually recommend you go and get sorted in other countries. But here, no. So we ignore that little problem because that's now getting into, you know, a whole other theoretical argument that the church doesn't see as part of this. They see annulment as completely different and therefore not relevant to this. It's still for life here. Going back to the statement, quote, the outcome of the vote will have serious moral, spiritual and social implications. It is the duty of each citizen to reflect very carefully on these implications and on the heavy responsibility that each of us bears in casting our vote. In our considered judgment, the introduction of divorce would be false kindness, misguided compassion, and bad law. End quote. It's in that last piece that's there. It's asking you to take responsibility that you've got in your vote. So that's all fine. The serious moral, spiritual, social implications. You have to reflect carefully on it. And then, and let me say, in that first part I read about the outcome having serious moral spiritual, that's in big bold writing. Then in tiny writing is that last little kicker. The introduction of divorce would be false kindness, misguided compassion and bad law. Look, you know, there is an opinion on this, but we're looking back now at this with a long time behind us. Many of the things that people feared would happen did not happen. They did not come out. You had groups like Youth Defence here who you know, continually said that there would be an absolute flood of these divorces and things that would you know, affect people. You'd Una Nick Mahuna of Youth Against Divorce making huge claims at the time about what was going to happen afterwards. We now know most of those didn't happen. The sky didn't fall in. And that's why this referendum matters, because it's the first time that when something gets passed, the sky doesn't fall in. But because it's the first time, it's very close. It starts to narrow really, really. This is going to be a nail-biting finish, because even with all the political parties there, even with all that, once the church and these others come out, there's this doubt, enough doubt. And remember, at the same time, political parties aren't holding the sway because trust is being eroded in them as well. Bertie Ahern is still only being, you know, evaluated as Fianna Fáil leader at this point, and his strength or his ability in it. So, look, they're struggling with it, and they're certainly struggling hard with their base in 1995 and modernizing them and pulling them along between their younger voters and their older voters. You have Fine Gael too, caught in a certain group who feel, you know, yes, John Bruton is. Now, again, he proves decisive, because Bruton comes out and makes an appeal in the last days of the campaign, which is really, really important for Conservative voters, where he talks about it and he points to the need for you know, voters to come out and back this. And that's crucial. And Bruton plays a really important role, because Fine Gael too, they've a lot of voters who begin to go, well, you know, are we being pulled into this by Labour and Democratic Left? They weren't. They had lots of their own Liberal voices, but yes, they were in coalition with these parties who definitely wanted it. And that begins to wear. And then there's always this thing of, well, do we want to give in to the Liberal crowd? Do we want to give them that? Do we want to say that that's what happened? That too becomes this huge problem for them. Going back to Saving the State, Fine Gael from Collins to Varadkar by Stephen Collins and Ciara Meehan, which, by the way, is only recently out and is quite an excellent read. We'll talk more about it later at another point, but it is a very interesting read to understand the Fine Gael mindset and how they view themselves. But in this book, they're talking about this run-in. They say, quote, just as happened in 1985, the strong support for constitutional change in the opinion polls began to evaporate during the referendum campaign. The No campaign was well organised and had the support of the Catholic Church. The slogan, "Hello Divorce, Goodbye Daddy," gained traction during the campaign, and in the final days there were strong indications that it could be defeated for a second time. The government went on a desperate offensive in the final weekend of the campaign, with Bruton taking a strong line in speeches and media appearances. Bruton was widely regarded as conservative on social issues, so his impassioned support for removing the ban on divorce had a serious impact. The Taoiseach did a brilliant interview on radio on the last Sunday of the campaign and undoubtedly swung some undecided voters our way, Fergus Findlay recorded in his memoir. Swinging even a few undecided voters was crucial, as the referendum was carried by a minuscule margin of 9,114 votes. It was the closest referendum result in the history of the state. 50.2% voting yes, 49.8% voting no. End quote. And there you see how this result, it narrows sharply. Fianna Fáil are out there, but they're not campaigning. So you have a lack of campaigning. It all follows the government. And then you get Bruton really trying to pull it out of the fire at the end. It's urban versus rural. It's those experiences of people versus people who have no experience of it. It's the idea of those battling against the society changing and those who are just disillusioned with everything saying vote no to everything every time. All of those things are conspiring. Then you throw in the church, and this is the last rattle of the church here. Can we show again that, yes, we still have this way? They know it's weakened. They definitely know that at this point. They know that from previous times, but they still feel we've got enough support. If we come out and we say it, people will still swing enough to go, you don't go against the Catholic opinion of the church. It's bad law, misguided compassion. It's not real kindness. You know, that's the tackling of this isn't, you know, compassion and kindness. These kind of things, this view of the church in these things, that's what's so tough, I think, for people to grasp. So when you get to this point, we get down to a referendum result that's going to be quite challenging in terms of constituencies, counties, quite divisive in where people come up with the results and how the results pan out. So I'm going to take a little look at just some of those results and how the referendum ended up won and lost, if you like, in this time, because it's a crucial period in the run-up to that campaign. It gets really close. Just the political parties aren't at the races here in the normal way they would be, and they are battling a really tough campaign elsewhere, and popularity is tough. Church might be down, but it's not out, and it has the influence, and these other groups are just creating. All you got to do here is create just enough doubt about what might happen for people to go, hold on, give it another few years before I change my mind. That's all you need for the victory in this case. So where does it all start to change? Because as I say, this becomes a really close fought contest. And you heard the result there, where there's this is one of the closest fought referendums in history, with over 9,000 votes separating both sides. And that's out of a turnout of 2.5 million vote, or 1.6 million voters out of 2.6 million voters. So it's about 62% turnout, 1.6 million votes, 818,842 vote yes, 50.28%, no, 809,728, 49.72%. It was on a razor's edge. So where did some of those votes come in? And what you begin to see is, if you especially look back at 86 referendum, take somewhere like Carlow Kilkenny, where you end up with the no vote winning in this referendum. 54.3% vote no, compared to 68.1% voting no in 1986. So you can see there that there's a particular drop, 10% in that drop in the no vote. So no still wins out, but it's struggling, it falls back. If you look at Cavan Monaghan, they too, 62% no. Again, so it's a strong no vote in Cavan Monaghan, but it's down 10% from the no vote it got in 1986. You go to somewhere like Clare, in 86, they were 68% no. In 95, they're 56% no. This 10% drop pattern you see replicated time and time again. Somewhere like Cork East, you see a really big change here. When you look at Cork East, 56.8% no in 1995, compared to 70.5% no in 1986. That's the kind of scale of changes that you're beginning to see. So you begin to see that the no side is strong in all the places you would expect it to be, but not strong enough. The votes are dipping. On the other hand, you take some places that switch. So you take somewhere like Cork South Central. Cork South Central, in 1986, votes 62% no. But in 1995, it votes 52.9%, so nearly 53% yes. So it switches completely. And those kind of constituencies are important, because they're the ones that really begin to change the mood. And you begin to look at it and go, again, when you're talking, you're only talking a handful of votes here, where, again, you're seeing a big no vote in those counties, but the no vote's coming down. So that's how you're seeing that big shift from 1986 right down to that change in 1995. You see some again, if you go into the likes of the Donegal constituencies, again, they're voting no, 73% and 69% no in the two Donegal constituencies, but that's down to 59% no in the 95 constituency. So those kind of changes. Then you get into some really interesting ones in Dublin, because Dublin's where you see the biggest shift in change. That was where in 86 it got some support. In places like Dublin North in 86, they got 50.6%, just about getting through. It gets 65% yes in this thing. Dublin Central voted 60.9% no. That's Bertie Ahern's constituency. 60.9% no in 86. Dublin Central is 57.2% yes. So almost complete reversal of position in 95. Indeed, you go down through it, and in 86 you have places like Dublin North Central, Dublin North West, Dublin South Central all voting no to it. Dublin all votes yes, and votes yes in considerable numbers, all over, you know, up to, you know, 58%, but most over 60, 64%, 66%. Somewhere like you know, you come down to the likes of some of the really the ones you would expect, maybe like Dunleary, they'd been 50.8% yes in 86, because they're one of the those constituencies that are considered liberal, with 68.2%. So again, they get a 10% increase on the yes side. Big urban areas, big vote numbers, turning in big votes for the yes side. And although you have a huge amount of those votes on the no side going out through, it's no in Galway East, Galway West, Kerry North, Kerry South, all there. But again, all down about 10% in terms of the actual no vote that was there in previous times. And against the rise in the yes constituencies and urban constituencies, that's simply not sustainable. Even in one that I will always look at, my own constituency of Longford West Meath, in 1986, 70.8% against the referendum. In Longford was with Longford Roscommon at this point, and it's 64.7% against this time. So you might say in that, although it's Roscommon opposed to Westmeath, but in the Longford side of it, it bears out. There was only a fractional, about 5% drop, so they don't get the traditional 10%. This is in Conservative heartland. You don't get that Conservative drop there as much, but it still is down about 5%. On what it had been. And then when you go down through the constituencies, that's where you see this change happen. You get all the others, all the ones who vote no in the referendum, Mayo East, Mayo West, Meath, Sligo, Leitrim, Tipperary North, Tipperary South, Waterford, Westmeath, Wexford, Laois, Offaly, Limerick West. They all vote no in it, but they're all no votes down on where they were in 86. Meanwhile, some, like Limerick East, are switching from no to yes. Loud switches from no to yes, and they're getting good votes in there. And meanwhile, the votes are going up particularly high. They're going jumps in votes. Somewhere like Wicklow jumps from being 53% no in 86 to 59% yes in 95. So that's where they pick up these votes. But it still comes down to just, you know, this slight change, because so many rural constituencies do vote no, do vote a majority no, so it's going to be close. You're depending on those urban centres turning in big wins, because if you were voting constituency by constituency, far more constituencies vote no than vote yes, but the weight in numbers is there. They don't do it in sufficient numbers. The gap isn't strong enough to overcome what are huge gaps in some of the urban constituencies, who, although smaller in number overall in terms of actual constituencies, how many of these constituencies there are, there's enough voters to do it, enough voters to see it through. That's kind of, I suppose, where it's won and lost. What is interesting, and I think just worth doing in this, is that there's some great records. And again, I want to thank my good friend Alan Kinsella at Election Lit again for some of the literature that we've referenced here. We also had some records from some of the newspapers at the time of the reactions that were given to the vote and what it was. For instance, Una Nick Mahuna of Youth Against Divorce said, "Is the Taoiseach willing to sign an affidavit to the effect that young women will not be slapped out on the road and made destitute? And if this scenario occurs, will these women be able to sue?" End quote. That was her reaction and pushing the matter with the Taoiseach. But there were some other great reactions. Des Hannafin, who was the chairman of the anti-divorce campaign. And remember, Des Hannafin is a senior figure in Fianna Fáil. He has fallen foul of Albert Reynolds for previously on the abortion issue. And Reynolds, being the kind he was if you're out, then you're out. Out you go. And had kind of thrown him out. Of course, he's a father of Mary Hannafin, well-known Conservative campaigner. He was very much on the Conservative side of Fianna Fáil, would have held huge sway within Fianna Fáil because of that. Well-respected guy. But his reaction to it, he was the chairman of the anti-divorce campaign, and his reaction to the result was, quote, "The priests are far-seeing men, and they had every right to get involved in the debate. The hierarchy come out in every country regarding important issues, and why should this country be any different? The papers and the media in general gave much more publicity to the no side, in particular the independent group. It seems the freedom of the press is in the owner's hands." End quote. So again, he's talking about, you know, the differencing groups and that, and the press and media. But interesting, he looks on the priests as being, you know, an important part, that they should be involved in the debate. And of course, because there was a hope that they were going to help swing it, even though in this occasion They obviously didn't, and didn't have the impact they were going they thought they'd have. The other person, who, as we said in the last referendum, had fallen foul of the changing political times, had been that Justice Rory O'Hanlon, who was chairman of the No Divorce campaign. And he said, quote, "People in urban areas were lazy, indifferent, and hostile to the teachings of the church. In this case, the people have ignored the church," end quote. And you can see there the problem with the this is why this, I suppose, side of the argument begins to struggle over future years. It becomes this labelling of people as lazy, indifferent, hostile to the teachings of the church, rather than actually dealing with the issues people were seeing on the ground. And yes, the church had been ignored, and it was a bit of a shock. It's the first time for many of these people who had support this to really realise the church can be beaten. This is the mark in 95 that the power had shifted considerably. Some of the others, as the results were coming in, Enda Kenny was the Minister for Tourism and Trade. He said, quote, "Many people in Ireland had travelled extensively, have seen different social pitfalls, and voted in terms of how these problems can be solved. As for the church's intervention, I don't think the Pope's comments were helpful from the No campaign's point of view," end quote. Enda Kenny there pointing to the fact maybe the church didn't help. The whole thing of sins and everything else, you know, just, and he probably has a strong point in this. It's not exactly the result that they might have been hoping for. Pat Rabbit, who was Minister of State in the government at the time, said, quote, "We have won by a whisker, but we have won, and that is what counts. That is the democratic process. You can't sell divorce like you are selling Christmas. That is a lesson we learned from the last time, and that is why it was harder to exercise our campaign than it was for our opponents," end quote. Pat Rabbit there pointing to one of a line, "You can't sell divorce like you're selling Christmas." Certainly not, but he claims it was harder to make that than the campaign. Very much disputed by Richard Green, who was from Winchester and Heron, when his reaction was, quote, "We were up against the odds the whole time, against six political parties, and we were denied fair access to the media. Any political party who doesn't get access to the national TV station is in an unfair position," end quote. And of course, there is, you know, that view. At the count, it was hostile. It was difficult. It was, you know, marked by, you know, that could have gone either way throughout the day, and people noted that. The result was announced. People were jubilant and celebratory, and people were, you know, very much devastated by the result in many respects when they put so much into the campaign, including Una McMahona, who is from Youth Against Divorce, who uttered, when the result was announced and the celebrations went in, probably the most famous line as she shouted across to those who were celebrating the result. She uttered the line that went down in history, I suppose, to define it, when she shouted across at them, "You're only a shower of wife-swapping sodomites." And that, I suppose, is that. And you can leave that comment to where it is. But this was the new era. Whether she believed that, or anybody else believes it, all these years on, we see a changed society, and we see a changed vision of what Ireland became after that. And that is, I suppose, where that result leaves us. But it is why 95 was an important referendum. This is the first time in all these social crusades and all this talk of how we're going to change things and adapt things and constitutional crusades, you see a big shift. You see a shift in terms of the politicians themselves. You see a shift in their attitudes to social issues and taking social issues on and beginning to progress things. You see the bases of the political parties too beginning to shift and change into how they approach issues. They're struggling themselves with many of them, but they're getting a very different view of the Ireland they want to create now. You have an Ireland that's beginning to show signs of real economic success. So it's really being felt at this stage. The numbers have been good for years, but now the jobs are coming online. The money's coming online. People are beginning to see the benefits of it. It's an entirely different country with an entirely new generation that believe definitely progress is possible. We've seen it time and time again, vote after vote, change does happen. And this referendum marks that point where they begin to say, yes, even when things seem like they're dodgy and it's close and it was a close one thing, but it's happened. One of the first big social challenges has now changed. We are now a country that does have divorce. Some people were terrified of it. Some people felt it was going to change everything about society and homes and families and the sky could fall in. What happens in the years after, though, is that for many people in the middle ground, the sky doesn't fall in. They don't see their neighbours suddenly en masse divorcing and changing. It doesn't change. What does change is that maybe problems are talked about a bit more where they do occur. We don't see vast numbers of things changing, but we see an acceptance that not everything is perfect the way we might have wished it once to be. And that's okay. We can deal with that as grown-ups. We can deal with it as a society, and people even begin to understand you can deal with it within whatever your faith is. But that from a place of compassion comes an ability to solve problems, and these were not beyond Ireland's ability to solve. And a major problem that had beset generations of people and had them arguing over it suddenly becomes one that's just there, done, dusted, forgotten. It doesn't become the everyday topic of conversation. It doesn't become something that defines everything from there on in. Life goes on, skies don't fall in, but it makes a huge difference to some people who felt they needed it. And from there grows a different view that society can be about compassion, and it doesn't always threaten us when it is. And it is possible for things in the state not to affect us directly that hugely affect other people. And all of that grows into this new sense of change that comes within Ireland at this time from 95 and that referendum. So it marks a big moment. It marks a moment when people feel a victory has happened that does change where political parties are going to go. And within the political parties, the fact that it's there, one of those major issues that divided people on the ground in the likes of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, the Broadchurch parties, is gone. Because it's in and it's not changing now, let's move on. And they begin to realise too that there is a great release in that politically for parties and leaders of having issues off the table. And that's why 95 matters so much, not just in terms of the divorce issue itself, but in terms of how Irish political parties begin to understand their role in developing a society and in how to handle these issues internally too. So that is it for this week and this podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. We will be moving on with the referendum series. So do stay tuned for the next episode, and we will be moving on into many more areas, back to mostly the European issues for the next while that will come centre stage for Ireland in it, but a couple of other big social ones as well do kick in over these years. I want to thank again Alan Kinsella at Election Lit on Twitter for again access to his great documents on the referendums that he has, and indeed on all election literature. As always, to my colleagues in Carr Communications for their support, their thoughts, their input, the access to the libraries and everything else that goes with it in bringing together this podcast too. So most of all, thank you all yet again for listening. I want to say a particularly big thank you. If you have heard this and if you've enjoyed it, please do give it a shout out on Twitter or Facebook or wherever your social media is. That's how we survive. That's how we get new listeners. That's how we keep the numbers up. But I want to thank so many of you who are loyal listeners to all of the podcast series, which continue to get listenership numbers far in excess of anything I had envisaged at the outset of this project. And really, I find that quite stunning and quite humbling that you're all out there listening to me for all these lengths of time. But hope you've enjoyed it. Please do interact with me on Twitter at Johnny Fallon. That's at JonnyFallon. And happy to hear any thoughts or views from you. But until the next time, take care, keep following your politics, keep in touch, and we'll be back very soon.